they had a moment where they took this turn, what I call the black pill, which is they decide that society is just completely morally bankrupt and it's going to collapse. And you might as well hasten its collapse because what comes after will be something better. And so, like anything they do is justified. Whether I was talking to a white nationalist or someone who wanted to overturn the results of the 2020 election.
Hey folks, Michael Steele here. Welcome to the podcast here on the Bulwark. So excited to have you land with us. I'm excited about our conversation today because Ellie Reeve has written an incredibly powerful and compelling book about the internet. She is a CNN correspondent, journalist. Her viral documentary, Charlottesville, Race and Terror, earned her an Emmy and Peabody Award. Her writing has appeared in Vice, The New Republic, New York Magazine, Elle, The Atlantic, and The Daily Beast. She is really good at what she does and really good at telling the story, which she has done in her latest work, Black Pill. I witnessed the darkest corners of the internet come to life, poison society, and capture American politics. We get a taste of that pill with my guest, Ellie Reeve, coming up right here next on the Michael Steele Podcast. Hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I am stoked to have my guest with us today, Ellie Reeve, who has written an incredibly good book. If you're looking for that summer read and you just like want to chill and just kind of like have a nice little cocktail, because you're going to need one when you read it. Just trust me, folks, you'll get excited. Black Pill: How I Witnessed the Darkest Corners of the Internet Come to Life, Poison Society, and Capture American Politics. Miss Reeves, welcome. So good to have you.
Thank you. It's really nice to
Yes.
talk to you.
You know, it's why I've been excited to talk to you, because this part of the landscape, both culturally and politically, has not been explored very well. And I think a lot of people really don't understand or have really figured out the degree to which the internet, social media, all of these platforms are changing people right before our eyes, changing our politics, changing the nature of our conversations, really putting things in a in as you know, in a poisonous way. So talk to us about you're coming to the point where you're like, I just got to write this ish down. I got to tell this story about what's going on out here.
Well, I just getting questions from other people. So I reported on the white nationalist rally in Charlottesville in 2017. And after that, tons of people wanted to talk to me. And their questions about it would have a lot of assumptions that were wrong, like that these guys were poor and economically downtrodden, that they're all local or they were all Southern, that there was some kind of like that they were the Klan.
Right.
I felt compelled to say, like, that this is who these guys are. They're not stupid. They're not poor. There's not like a giant, extremely powerful organization behind them that is puppeteering it all. There is a small organization that has tried to shape the public discourse that way.
Right.
And another element is that I used to think that the internet did not change people's behavior, that it just revealed it. But I just don't think that anymore. There's this way where when you're inside a certain online bubble, something like a Discord server, a chat room, a group chat, whatever, you see these messages over and over and over again. It does shape your thoughts and it does push you to more radical ideas.
So what is the dark side of all of this? What is this space that you talk about, the darkest corners of the internet? What is that? Where is that? And Is there a lane that takes you into it, or
Yeah.
is it your Twitter feed? What is it?
So there's an anonymous message board called 4chan. A lot of people have heard of it by now because so much dark stuff has come out of it. But it used to be the engine of humor on the internet. Like it essentially innovated the meme itself. It was pro-Obama back in the day. I don't know if you saw the meme where it was like Obama speaking when Sarah Palin became picked as VP, and it says, "Everybody chill the F out. I got this." Like that's like a 4chan type thing. But over time, as more and more normal people started going on this site, which is anonymous and which would purge all the messages every few days so that it really rewarded compulsive use, they started doing neo-Nazi jokes to offend p outsiders to keep them away. But over time, they started believing it. There's this idea that what one generation of a community does as parody, the next generation will come in and miss all those social cues and take it as sincere. So over time, it becomes the thing that it was making fun of. So over time, like this one part of 4chan became a fascist website. And it was just the engine that created the alt-right. It didn't create that name, but it created the entire culture behind it.
It's so what does that say? What does that say that something can start out good and wholesome, fun, sort of a place where people are making really funny jokes and coming up with some wild, crazy memes that are not offensive, and then suddenly it just becomes this darker thing. Does that poison come from us, or is that poison something that forms in time? Like you said, indicated there that people s start putting in stuff to keep others out or to keep the thing moving in a certain direction, and that then becomes the thing. I mean, I'm just trying to understand how do we get to a space where the ugliest side of us becomes the most dominant thing, as opposed to our good nature and our sort of lovely disposition?
So Frederick Brennan, who as a teenager created 8chan, which became the place where QAnon posted all of its posts, he had imagined the no rules free speech paradise where like the best ideas would battle out and rise to the top. And it's just
So
not how
Elon
it
before there was Elon, right?
100%. It's so bizarre to me to watch Elon and other tech guys imitating teenagers from 4chan. I mean, it's like people I interviewed, they're like saying things
You just
that
put that so perfectly well.
it's like a replay of literally 10-year-old ideas that were created by people who like teenage fascist virgins. Like literally, that was their identity. I mean, it's just crazy to me. I have a hard time sometimes believing what I'm seeing. But anyway, what Fred Brennan told me is that in retrospect, the best ideas did not rise to the top. The most angry, like Nazis and misogynists, they made the normal people leave. And then the other people who were receptive to it, they became more radicalized.
Well, Tim, that's interesting because you say in the book, and I just pulled up one of the pages that I highlighted. You're talking about fascists. It's in chapter five, Smart People, right? Where you're talking about smart people, and you talk about fascists notice empty gestures of corporate responsibility, the makeup brand posting about police violence, the investment bank sponsoring Pride Week. And we've had some discussions about how corporate America wants to be socially connected and responsible, so they adopt all these things that really are not part of their brand or what they do, but they're trying to be again socially responsible. And you were saying that fascists notice this and use it to attack all work for social justice as cynical and self-interested. You go and you say they notice that smart people need to feel like they're logical, principled thinkers, and so they create cringe propaganda to make them feel alienated from activists for social justice. Cringe propaganda is video of, or screenshots of someone who's advocating for equality being provoked into a big emotional outburst, as in the YouTube genre, social justice warrior gets destroyed, or the epic Twitter dunk. So you have these folks who seemingly have figured out how to, I call it punking, how to punk the system into certain behavior, or punking them into believing that certain behavior is good or bad. Talk a little bit about how that works with these darker forces really kind of turning the system on its head and using it against itself.
Right. So these guys are not stupid. And they also are very obsessive. They read more than I read. They read liberal and conservative magazines. They read all these opinions in order to better satirize them. And another part of their activism is, yes, they want to draw more people in. They want to radicalize more people, but they also want to demoralize the mainstream and the moderates. And they're very good at creating these images that say, well, you don't want to be like those people. You don't want to be like that trans lady who's acting so crazy in the street. Like they create names for these people who have been triggered, you know, in street confrontations and become the poster of what the left believes. You can see how powerful this idea is, again, with like folks like Elon Musk, people in Silicon Valley who imagine themselves as intellectuals who are capable of coolly analyzing the facts on the ground to come to their conclusions, when really this is driven by emotion. Or Ben Shapiro, for example, you know, he and folks like him tour these college campuses, and college students who maybe aren't that prepared to engage in these arguments get upset. They ask them questions, and these guys make the kids look stupid, and then they package those videos and send them out to the far right and raise money off of them.
Interesting. So walk us through your journey, because that's what the Black Pill is. It's sort of your journey into this space, and the cast of characters that you run into that kind of make up this sort of weird internet environment, where, as you already noted, you know, these extremists make their plans. They know how to package them. They know how to draw others into it. And it really kind of, I guess, in one sense, as you note, you know, January 6th for you was not surprising. Right, because you kind of saw it come. You saw the background notes being developed, and the storylines that were right there beneath the surface for a lot of these groups that sort of culminated in that action. But I want to get a sense for you of how, why this journey? What was it that triggered for you? Oh, you know what? I'm gonna put the boots on and go walk through this sludge.
In the Obama era, there was this idea that bigots were dying off. Like all the old, you know, America was having this fundamental democratic
change. Yeah, we elected a Black president.
We like racism is Nirvana. Okay. It's not over, but it's like kind of over. And I happened to be on 4chan researching another story when Microsoft released this chatbot. It was supposed to be AI. It was called Tay and talked like a teenage girl. And she's supposed to learn how to be more human by interacting with people on Twitter.
Right.
And 4chan figured out very quickly they could turn her into a Nazi. And the only organizing principle. No, and they did. They succeeded within.
They could turn her into a Nazi.
They had her praising Hitler. I think she rated this Holocaust from 1 to 10. She rated it a steaming 10. She circled Hitler's face and wrote swag alert under it. And the only organizing principle here on this like anonymous message board was each person was trying to outdo the last guy. Like they didn't know each other, but they were able to work together so quickly. And Microsoft took Tay down. That was when I realized that there were young and smart and educated people who had been drawn into really, really dark, explicit bigotry. Not like, I mean, like very explicit racial slur using pro-Holocaust beliefs. And there were so many of them. And so I was like, I just couldn't let it go. I mean, honestly, sometimes my boss would just be like, all right, you need to move on. Like, can you pitch a different story?
Okay,
Like,
Ellie, understand, but it's time for you to work on something else.
yeah. In tw so in 2017, in the spring, so this is several months before the big Charlottesville rally, I learned that they were going to do a little unannounced rally in Charlottesville where they would hold torches in front of this Robert E. Lee statue. And what blew my mind was that they were developing like a protective force for self-defense because Richard Spencer, the white nationalist, had been punched in the face and they were scared he was going to get killed. And I couldn't really articulate it well at the time, but it seemed really significant to me that they had these like ex-military and ex-cop guys who were working together to like arm themselves to protect this white nationalist movement. And that just seemed like an escalation to me that could be very dangerous.
So, my brain right now is going in seven different directions because
Yeah.
there are just so many pieces of what you have described that pushes up against questions about the individuals themselves,
Yeah.
the movement that they have fallen into. And it's interesting because Nazism, fascism, white nationalism, certainly the KKK, these institutions of domestic violence, which they are, and it still stuns me. And maybe you can tell us why our government refuses to identify the thing for what it is.
Yeah.
Any clue on that, by the way? Well, this is a quick sidebar from your
Sure.
reporting.
I actually spoke to people at the FBI off the record, who said that after 9/11, the only game in town was international terrorism, Islamic terrorism, and that white nationalist domestic terrorism was just kind of a backwater. And there were only a few people who were assigned to
They
monitor
knew, they
that.
know they blew up a building, right? In right? Did
I
that.
mean, there's lots of reporting from 2016, 2017 about how law enforcement was taken by surprise by these guys. They did not see it coming.
It's the so that's important. That's an important pin, I think, for why we see ourselves where we are right now with the hard right consuming the Republican Party, my party, which is now MAGA, on the heels of the nomination of J.D. Vance and Trump. That ticket is a solidification of that. But it's still pulling back from that specifically. It still sort of makes you wonder about Charlottesville and what happened there. You have these young individuals in their khakis and their tiki torches, and they're screaming these horrible things about Jews and Black people. And it begged for me the question with this generation, how did their parents raise them? And what I'm hearing from you and what I gleaned from the book was, it's not so much how their parents raised them, is what they fell into, what they were exposed to on the internet. So mama and daddy could be God-fearing, good men and women who raised their kids to love thy neighbor as thyself, et cetera. Don't see race in anything, But that kid at 14, 15 on the internet falls into a deeper, more destructive thing. Am I off there? In
No,
terms of
no. Yeah.
how we should start to look at these things, because young before the internet, it was how racism was taught, and it's still taught, but the question is, who's the teacher?
Right. Yes, that's a good way to put it. I wanted to tell the story of who did this, who made this happen, who brought these ideas forward, who brought this violence into the world. And I looked long at there are many different backstories. Some had very difficult childhoods, some had perfectly fine middle class suburban childhoods. But what they all had in common was this nihilism. They had a moment where they took this turn, what I call the black pill, which is they decide that society is just completely morally bankrupt and it's going to collapse. And you might as well hasten its collapse because what comes after will be something better. And so, like, anything they do is justified. Like, they are justified in what they're doing because they are taking on this morally bankrupt system. And I just found that was true, whether I was talking to a white nationalist or someone who wanted to, overturn the results of the 2020 election.
Right. Where I guess where do we go from moments like that from like Charlottesville, where you have a sitting president at the time saying, "Oh, they're fine people on both sides." And no, they're not. And yet there's a larger percentage of Americans who do look at these behaviors who, to this point, are not in this space. They're not in the darker reaches of the internet as you talk about it. You know, their grandmamas. I've heard some stuff out of grandmamas on their Facebook pages that I'm like, damn, bitch, where'd you come from? You know, what lit you up? So what is it? How infectious is the poison? Is that black pill? Because seemingly you don't have to necessarily take it directly to suffer from the effects of it.
One of the things they exploit is that knowledge gap. So white nationalists will use a slogan like, it's okay to be white. And then people who are in the know will be outraged and they'll protest because they're like, this is a white nationalist slogan intentionally coined on extremist message boards to provoke people. But people who aren't in the know will be like, wait a minute, like, why isn't it okay to be white? So in Charlottesville, likewise, they had intended to chant, you will not replace us. So that people would think, like, yeah, what's wrong with these guys not wanting to be replaced? What's wrong with them wanting to continue their culture? What's wrong with them wanting to have a white family? But they got so excited and they marched for so long that they ad-libbed and they said, Jews will not replace us. And that is what revealed, like, the true intention behind their ideas. It revealed what they were really all about, which is this deranged anti-Semitic conspiracy theory.
So when you're writing this and you're delving into this space, what's going through your mind? You're interacting with Nazis and white supremacists. That's not a cup of orange juice in the morning. That's pretty toxic stuff. What are you thinking as you're sitting there talking to these people and interacting with them? Because I'd probably be in a different headspace, but
It's pretty dark. It's pretty dark sometimes.
mean, so how do you keep yourself tethered to the light when you're talking to someone that dark?
I did get concerned at points that they would, for lack of a better word, win, that they would be able to persuade more people. And one thing that was comforting was after Charlottesville, many people in power actually did take action to stop them, like financial services companies, social media companies, just people in general, people in their neighborhoods. How do I? I mean, one of my more ridiculous ways of staying sane is I always go running before an interview, and in it, I have these delusional fantasies of beating my interview subject in sports, right? Like in feats of strength and courage, And then I get home and I'm like, I probably won't turn this interview into a push-up contest. That might be weird. And then I do think it's so important to document this and like say this is what really happened, and that urge to tell other people like this is what is happening. That keeps me going.
So why, so is there a difference between, so okay, so this is a two-part sort of approach here. The subjects of this are largely white, correct?
Largely, but not entirely. Yeah.
Largely, so talk about that. How does a person of color land in this space talking about their, do they see that, are they coming from the perspective of we want an all black culture, or are they just like, yeah, white folks need to have their own thing?
Oh,
Because I don't understand. I don't understand
complicated.
when someone is saying, N-word, I don't say that, I don't want to say it, but N-word, go home. The brother marching with them is like, who are you talking to? I mean, I don't understand that. Help me understand that piece of it, and then we'll get to the
Yeah.
other part.
There are definitely some people who are drawn to these cultures that hate them. What I've seen the most is people with some Latino heritage being interested in white nationalism because, South America, Central America, they have different understandings of what white is than what
Right.
America has. So I talked to this white nationalist who interviewed people to join a white nationalist frat called Identity Europa. They marched in Charlottesville. And she said she often would get people who were part Latino or even half Jewish be like, but I can join, right? Like I'm white too, right? It's like, no, you're not. Like we don't want you. And they'd be disappointed.
They'd be disappointed.
There's also, all right, let me tell you a story. Okay, that really sent me down this rabbit hole. 2013 CPAC. There was a panel called Trump the Race Card. Are you tired of being accused of being a racist when you know you're not? And I was like, I want to know what this is all about. So I go, it's packed. And I took the last seat, which happened to be a seat that a white nationalist was saving for his buddy. And this panel broke down in pandemonium when the white nationalist was like, there was like Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass or whatever. But then in the 60s, with Nixon's Southern strategy, a lot of Republicans embraced segregation and anti-civil rights and act. And we should go back to that. That was good. And then people were really angry. And then there was a leftist woman in the crowd. And she was like, yeah, he's right. Like, that's what happened. And it's just like uproar. It's crazy. And there was a young black guy, like college kid, maybe 20, in the room. And he was like, I'm just tired of feeling like a victim. And all these white people in the room just exploded in applause. And that was like, I don't know. It was just a moment that really hit me viscerally because it was, I think that kid had a different idea of what he meant by that than
Yep.
what the audience had.
Yep.
But that audience, their desire for that was so strong. It was really disturbing to me. But I do think there are a lot of people who are alienated by some of the language of social justice where it feels like you're they're the victim. I mean, I'm a woman. Like I've read lots of stuff like that where you always feel like you're back heels, you're being oppressed. You are the subject of the sentence. You're not the
Right.
object of the sentence. And they don't want to feel that way. They don't want to be sad. They want to be mad. I mean, I have felt that way, So I think that's part of it. I mean, there were a lot of women who were involved in the
So
alt-right.
that was my next piece, because a lot of people see this as largely a white male, young white male thing. But you talk about women. There are women who are involved in who very much, I mean, you just in this story you just told, you were talking to a woman who was like, yeah, no, we get these people coming in and we'll have to turn them away. So how do women fit into this?
Right. So white nationalism has been around for a very long time, obviously, but the alt-right was this new sort of internet focused, like part of white nationalism starting like the late Obama administration.
Right.
So that was much more misogynist than the old white nationalism because it was influenced by incel culture, involuntary celibates who feel that their faith has doomed them to a life of celibacy
Oh,
and all that.
so they couldn't find a date, so that this is what they resort to
Yes. And they'll never get
seriously.
laid and they're
Never got
raging about the
laid, and
widow.
here we are.
I mean, it's like funny. There's a lot of dark jokes about it, but people have committed mass murder over these ideas. There was a guy who drove a van through a huge crowd of people in Toronto who did it to start an incel uprising. So it's like, I mean, as a woman, like walking through these crowds, it would be so like so crazy, like so hostile and but in a creepy way. Like I'd much rather be screamed at by a regular Trump supporter who hates CNN than by these guys who are kind of sick puppies who have this like edge of like really creepy incel, like I don't know, resentful virgin. I don't know. I mean, the virginity thing, it sounds so ridiculous to say it, but like that is a core part of their identity, is these angry virgins.
So the angry virgin.
Yeah,
Okay,
but
so
so a lot
I
of
got
women,
I
a lot of
never
women.
I would the angry virgin. Yeah. And a lot of that's probably tied to being bullied when they were younger for
Yes.
a host of things, because they were awkward or they didn't have running butt partners that they could run with in high school or whatever.
Yes.
And so they find this new community of like-minded angry virgins. And that is where a lot of this sort of crazy stuff sort of ferments. And then you feed into that these other ingredients, anti-Jew, anti-Black. Does it become a thing where they start projecting that anger back, and it sort of lands in all these other buckets when at the end of the day, it's all about the fact that they didn't get laid in high school?
Yeah, I mean, they created an entire ideology out of it. Like, why are they being denied women? So, the basic incel thesis is that everyone is ranked from 0 to 10 in terms of hotness. Okay. And in the good old days, tens marry tens and threes marry threes. But then feminism came along and it removed the stigma of women having sex with multiple partners. So, because women will naturally, in their view, always try to sleep with the highest status person, and men will sleep with anybody, all of the hot men are sleeping with all of the women. So, the 8, 9, and 10 men are getting the 0 through 10 women. And that
Right.
means the 0 through 3 men are left alone forever.
They got nothing.
So, and who is doing this? Who is to blame for this? If you add in more of the white nationalist ideas, they're conspiracy theory is that Jews want to dilute the white race in order to have control over the population and protect themselves. So, and there's just a lot of mixing together of that. And they also believe that women evolved to be more conformist because in ancient times, when tribes would invade each other, all the men would be killed and the women would be taken as war brides, and those who refused would be killed. So, women who refused to go along with the mainstream didn't pass on their genes. It's just evolution. It's just science. That's their idea. It's just science. And so they're very
Interesting.
angry at women for conforming to the dominant liberal ideology and perpetuating this and denying them sex. So, like, that's all cooking in there, right? But a lot of women, many of who have abuse in their backgrounds, are drawn to the alt-right and the trad lifestyle with this idea that these men want to protect women
Right.
and respect them as long as they are traditional housewives who cook and clean and
Because they
adore
don't
them.
feel protected and respected outside of that space.
Exactly. They feel like if they are attached to a powerful guy within this world, they're going to be safe. It doesn't work out that way. There are many public cases of these women abusing or accusing their white nationalist ex-boyfriends or ex-husbands of physical abuse or emotional abuse. But for a
Well, and
time,
that would speak makes sense because in many respects, by that point, a good number of those men have a distorted view of what a relationship is. And at any moment, if that woman doesn't conform to what they have made up in their minds, what that relationship is, that abuse is going to come. That's the reaction to it. I am
They
the man.
also want to look cool in front of their friends
I
and
will look
show that
cool.
they are dominating this
I was going
woman.
to say they're the dominant figure. Ellie Reeve, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk about why a lot of these folks project this masculinity on one of the least masculine political figures in modern times. More with Ellie Reeve right after this.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm having a fascinating conversation, and I hope you're really getting into this as much as I am, because I have 1,001 questions that I can't keep Ellie all day, but we are enjoying this conversation with Ellie Reeve, who is the author of Black Pill, How I Witnessed the Darkest Corners of the Internet Come to Life, Poison Society, and Capture American Politics. I want to talk about the capturing American politics part, because the dark corners of the internet have created images of itself and of other political figures, but none more than Donald Trump. We've seen images of Donald Trump looking like, I mean, making Arnold Schwarzenegger looking like Pee Wee Herman, right?
Yes.
What is that all about? What is the psychology there that they project this masculinity on a guy who is the least masculine figure that I can think of? Overweight, he lies about his weight, balding, he grows his hair long to comb over. And other attributes that really kind of don't signal confidence and strength. I won't even get to his fingers, his little hands. But what is that all about? What should we learn, or what even did you learn from some of that?
Something I heard over and over in different groups, whether it was white nationalists, QAnon, gun rights advocates, was it started as a joke and then became real. So in the beginning, it was just kind of funny to like Donald Trump because he made people angry, and they particularly made the people they didn't like angry, you know, with the comment, people reacting to Trump calling Mexicans rapists, that made so many people angry, and they love that. That's when they thought, that was really captured their attention. And that Trump wasn't cowed. Like, people would criticize what he had said and he wouldn't back down from it. They loved that. After the 2016 election, one fascist told me that Trump was a pussy grabbing asshole, but he was our pussy grabbing asshole. They said he reminded them of the 80s, that of this like time with like masculine swagger. You look at the movies and TV and ads from back then, and it's mostly all white, and the men are dominant, and the women are ornamental bimbos. And they liked that, and they wanted to go back to that. Matt Heimbach, a white nationalist who has since said he's no longer part of that world, he's a Marxist-Leninist now, he says. He described Trump's election as better than sex, that it was not so much about Trump himself, but just that all of the people who had hated him and made his life miserable were so angry and upset about it. You know, there are all those viral videos of Hillary fans crying. Well, this is the audience for it.
And they got off on that.
They loved it. Absolutely. They wanted to see pain in these other people.
What does that tell you when you talk to someone or you see that expression played out that way? What did that, from your reporting, what does that say to you about where we are and how this plays out for the rest of us?
Well, I think it speaks to this really terrible nihilism and a decline in empathy for a fellow man. There's been some social science research on internet trolls, and it says that they have high cognitive empathy, meaning they understand the feelings you feel, but low affective empathy. So they don't feel what you feel. If you stub your toe, they're not cringing in sympathy. And so that's why they're so good at manipulating people's emotions. And so there might be
Or you just
people.
described Trump.
Right.
You just described him. I mean, because he's very high. I mean, he understands. He understands the sacrifice made by a Gold Star family member. But he has no empathy or a way to express that empathy because it doesn't register for him. And it's interesting you raise that because after the shooting, there was a friend of Trump's who was on our air at MSNBC talking with one of our hosts about his conversation. He called him up. He says, you only get about 2 or 3 minutes whenever you talk to him. And he called to check in on him, see how he was doing. And he asked him the question, coming this close to losing your life, are you introspective about that? How did that affect you? And Trump wouldn't answer the question. He did not answer. There was no emotional connection, which is why I've been trying to help, say to people, for Trump, everybody's sitting there going, oh, well, you have a brush with death. You life flashes before your eye. You kind of reorder things. You kind of look at things. He's gonna come out differently. No, he's not. Because I don't think the man emotionally can go to that point with himself to say, damn, maybe my shit has had an impact on people, and this is the result of that someone lashed out, and maybe I should dial it back, or maybe I shouldn't say the things that I've been saying. I just don't think that's in him to do that. He's not shown in his 81 years the capacity to do that. So you make a very, I think, important point in understanding how this is processed for a lot of these people,
I
because there
mean,
is
look
that.
at Trump in the moment. In the moment he was shot, he jumps up with real anger in his face, pumping his fist.
Right. And you have to ask, if you were just shot, your ear was injured, you were injured in that moment, you would stand up and fight defiantly? Or would you have a different reaction? And for him, it's the combination of that part of the ego, but also the showman in him recognizing I can brand the moment. And again, that's a dispassionate connection to it. There's no emotional connection to it. His Secret Service, you can watch it. The Secret Service detail couldn't get him off the stage because he wanted to stay there for the moment. He wanted to create the imagery. And you see with a lot of the narratives throughout the book, that is a part of, is creating this imagery, this sort of, we are stronger than we actually may be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a bluff. But yes, it's so important to them to portray themselves with this like swaggering masculinity. And after Charlottesville, the recriminations were not like, we killed a woman. It was, oh, some people kind of looked fat in their polos, you know, oh, that guy didn't look cool. That guy looked out of control. You shouldn't have screamed that. It always comes back to like, it sounds so juvenile, but to looking cool, to looking based. I don't know if you're familiar with that slang, but to looking like there's no amount of scolding from the elites that would ever make you change what you believe.
That's stunning. I mean, when you stop and think about someone losing their life, and in that moment, they're critical of the way people look.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, there's massive. It's called optics. They have a whole term for that debate.
What do nationalist groups look like before the internet? How do you compare the before times to what you've discovered now?
Well, they were based in geography, and they were generally more working class. They were the older sort of eugenicist professorial types, but skinheads, neo-Nazis, those guys were more working class and based in one area. So Jeff Skoop, who ran the National Socialist Movement for almost 30 years, told me that, yeah, they would try to recruit teenagers who were like angry, and maybe they'd already been in some fights before. They were usually didn't have a lot of money. And he, when he was a teenager, he had wanted to know more about Nazis. So he found an academic book in the library that had an index with the addresses of all the people that the author had interviewed. And so Skoop wrote letters to all these different groups around the country asking for their literature. And he was so frustrated because it took forever to get back, or maybe they'd get really like old stuff that was out of date. He finally got one Christian nationalist woman to invite him to a book fair, and she hooked him up with what became known as the National Socialist Movement. So it was very difficult for him. Like, he had to work really hard.
All right, right.
Then he described in, you know, the early 2010s, as the alt-right comes online, he's like very confused by that, because they seem like rich boys. They seem like, in his words, girly boys. They're posting really misogynist memes. He described seeing a image of a white woman who had been beaten up, and the implication was that she deserved to be raped. And he was appalled by this, because he imagined himself as the protector of white women. He had this whole story about once seeing a woman being robbed by a black man on the street, and none of the other white men around were willing to do something about it, and he was willing to do something about it. So all these guys come online and they hate white women. He's shocked by this. He's like, he told me, you know, someone had posted that back in my day, they would have gotten a boot party, meaning severely beaten.
Mm-hmm.
But now this had taken over. He wondered if they were gay. He didn't understand it. And he didn't hang out with them. And eventually, though he did go to Charlottesville, he eventually quit the movement and renounced it.
What can you tell us about these young men? Are they in any other, individually, are they weak? Or are they, is it their strength comes from the collective? I mean, what, because I think, you know, I was talking with some folks about this before, and certainly at the time of Charlottesville in 17, and certainly given a lot of the stuff that we see emanating out of this current iteration of the Republican Party, you know, or Charlie Kirk, you know, stuff like, you know, guys like that, you know, they get their ass kicked on any block in the neighborhood. You know, they come walking with that shit and start running their mouths. But somehow they, again, going back to the imagery that's created around Donald Trump, you know, looking like an Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, prototype. they sort of have this projection of their own masculinity. But when you get up in their faces, what's that like when you're up in their grill?
Yeah, one-on-one. I mean, I've had several cry while talking to them. You know, no one really listens to them, and they don't believe in therapy. They think that's a Jewish conspiracy too. So,
oh, therapy is a Jewish conspiracy. Okay.
That's right, Freud. You know,
yeah, there you go. Yeah.
You don't have to think too deeply.
Yeah,
about
you
it.
Got mommy issues. You just don't want to talk about, right? Is that where we're going?
Yeah. So now there are a few. So I like watch their videos of their public fights, right? And I look for the ones who actually know how to throw a punch, will punch a woman, will punch a woman on camera, right? I want to give those guys a big radius. But most of them, you know, I had this one white nationalist that I had tangled with in the past, and I'm in Charlottesville, and I'm walking down the, it's all broken up, national emergency or state emergency declared. They're sort of evacuating the park, and I hear this voice that I recognize shouting my name, and I turn around, arms out, and I'm like, hey. It's a long time coming. I start walking towards him. Admittedly, this is a weird thing to do, right? But walking towards him with my arms outstretched. And he grabs his bodyguard and pulls him in between us. And this guy had hundreds of Nazis at his back. And I had my crew. And I'm 5'7". You know,
like, right.
And that, I mean, of course, I hold on to that moment and I savor it because I felt like it really spoke to the reality of who this guy was. Likewise, Chris Cantwell, he's the guy I interviewed in Charlottesville that went on to be known as the crying Nazi. He was maced multiple times in Charlottesville, which hurts. It does hurt. But he, even other white nationalists would say he was traumatized by that and really shouldn't be engaging in public activity like this because he was too sensitive. So he would repeat it to me over and over and over. Like, I got maced twice in so many days. Like, I got maced twice in 2 days. Like, he really felt like a victim. And the night of the torch march, that's when the people have the tiki torches, they're shouting, Jews will not replace us. That march ends with them encircling some couple dozen at the most students who are circled around a statue counter-protesting, and they beat them up, total melee. And Cantwell kept saying to me, like, we were attacked, we were attacked. And I'm like, I said to him, like, but you outnumbered those kids 10 to 1. He's like, oh no, it was like 20 to 1. And I'm like, well, do you not see? Like, you are the aggressor. But he just could not see it that way. He even played videos of himself in that torch march when he was done on trial in federal court over his role in organizing Charlottesville. He thought these videos were exculpatory. And yet they show him jumping into a dog pile, punching someone in the back. Like, I just feel like that's one-on-one. Like, if you're punching someone in the back, you're the bad guy. But he just could not see it that way.
Why, and why is that, do you think? Why could he, is the indoctrination is so deep, or his own separate belief system is so strong that he creates this sort of victimhood to justify his aggression?
I think with Cantwell, his own personal victimhood narrative intertwined very neatly with the white nationalist victimhood narrative. And so I think even if he'd found a different ideology, he would still fundamentally be the same person.
Interesting. Interesting. So before we let you go, I this part of the book, I just kind of chuckled, because so this is the stupid part of our conversation, people, just so you know exactly where I'm going. So, you note in a congressional hearing about diversity in military academies in 2023, Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz, okay, so you know where I'm going with this, folks, asked Lieutenant General Richard Clark, superintendent of the United States Air Force Academy, about the school's statement that, quote, a diverse and inclusive force is a war-fighting imperative, end quote. So Gaetz then comes back with the question, were the Mongols diverse? Raising his already pointy eyebrows. Were the Vikings diverse? Clark did not take the bait and simply said he was building a fighting force from the nation's population, which was the most diverse in the world. Gates went on to grill him about a scholarship open to a variety of gender identities. The exchange came just 6 years after I listened to a racist podcast to ridicule the idea that diversity is our strength. What does that exchange tell you about our political leadership and how feckless and unimportant in one sense it is, but how dangerously stupid it is in another? I sort of led the witness here, folks, I know. And I apologize. I probably shouldn't have done that. But the problem I have with people like Matt Gaetz is he has no understanding and appreciation of what General Richard Clark is about, has no appreciation of what our military service is. And yes, the Mongols and the Vikings were homogeneous. We are not. That's why the general's response was, well, I'm talking about our military is built on the men and women who live in the country. What, right. You just want an all-white military force? Is that what you're saying, Matt? But anyway, I'll let you share with us your points.
Well, no, in that way, I do feel the same way. It's so what? Like a lot of times when the mainstream conservative movement, the Republican Party, has figured out the power of these provocative statements and these trolling statements and this sort of masculine bravado, like that really appeals to people. And I just always want to ask them, and so what? So what? So you want us to be more like the Vikings? Should the infantry be all white? Is that what you want? Like, say what you mean. Like, don't be scared. Like, if this is what you believe, don't be afraid to say it. These ideas that these guys have had, like, most of the leaders that I have interviewed, they are in difficult circumstances now, like divorce, battling addiction, some went to jail. Like, it did not work out for them. Their old white nationalist buddies all turned on them. Like, it is a terrible life. Everyone who touches these fascist movements gets destroyed. But those ideas are just trickling up into mainstream society. And I used to like hold on to like little quotes that I thought were revealing of this, but there's too many now. I can't keep track of it all. Like at Turning Point, they handed out hats that said White Boy Summer last month. I genuinely want to ask them, like, what do you mean by this? Like, what do you want from this?
Yeah, what
like,
is a White Boy Summer?
Well, it's a stupid meme. I mean, right. It's a stupid meme that circulated on 4chan, but what does it mean to
What does it mean? Yeah. And I think, you know, I think in one sense, a lot of young white boys get caught up in that, particularly if they're coming out of difficult family circumstances or communities where, you know, it's stressed out for them. And this becomes a good escape where they find, quote, family, they find connection, they find relationships. But it's like you've already said, it's toxic. It doesn't end well. At the end of the day, it just doesn't end well for you. And where are you in your 40s? This is where you start in your 20s.
Right.
And what does it mean for the country? And I think that's part and parcel of what we're going to discover with the shooter in Butler this past weekend, that this young 20-year-old white boy, who his friends on camera said, not friends, but people in his class said, was bullied to an extreme. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the way it was described, it was like, it was relentless. It was a constant part of his high school life. And so how do we see that translating later in his life? Well, now we know. And it becomes, I think, a very important conversation that we have to have about what the internet is hiding in the corner. Mm-hmm. which is why your book is so good. Go ahead. No, you.
There are some people there who cannot find friends anywhere else. But if they go to this world and they are willing to say the N-word, if they're willing to say the Holocaust didn't happen, they are accepted. And that's the only place they can find friends. And setting aside, like, do we deserve to do some, do those person people deserve for us to do something nice for them? Like, you could have an argument about that, but just in the interest, in the self-interest of everyone else, I do think we need to look at, maybe we should not let that kind of bullying happen in our high schools. And I also think there needs to be, just like there's remedial math and reading, there needs to be remedial social skills instruction for kids who struggle to connect with the rest of the world. Because at this point, like, it is in our self-interest, those of us who can make small talk, to make sure that everyone is able to, like, feel like they have a place in society. I mean, this kid, there's very limited that we know about the shooter from Butler, but so far, into computer programming, quiet, bullied, loner. I mean, it lines up with many of the people that I've interviewed in my book.
Yeah. Yeah. That, folks, like I said, it's a read that you got to do. Ellie's put together a great storyline, but also some really important insights into this culture. I'm not even going to call it a subculture, because it, in my estimation, it runs parallel to everything else we're doing. And you've got young people dipping in and dipping out, dipping in and dipping out, and then they dip in and they don't come out. It's important for us to understand that and how, and that's why I wanted to pull the Matt Gaetz piece, how our political class, our politicians exploit that. Mm-hmm. They're not trying to solve for it. They're actually trying to take advantage of it. And wittingly or unwittingly, and I think in the case of Matt Gaetz, it's a question how much wit is involved here. They project out certain things and they give credence and justification for this mindset to continue, as opposed to, you know, as we talked a little bit before, going back and seeing those moments where we either turn into the light or we turn into the darkness. And we need leaders who are going to help us keep our young people from falling into this very, very dark corner of the room.
Exactly. They're looking for leadership. They're desperate for it. So show some.
Show some. Ellie Reeve, you really just rocked the conversation here. I appreciate you so much coming on and sharing with us Black Pill. And again, I encourage everyone to get it. It's a good read. It's engaging. But it's going to take your mind some places you probably don't want to go or didn't think you could go, to better understand exactly how this is evolving and how it has evolved for us, and why so many of our young men and women are getting caught in this dark corner of the internet. Thank you so much for taking time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was really great talking to you. I had a great time.
No, it was wonderful. It's wonderful. I appreciate it. And so, folks, that does it for our conversation this time. Please check out Ellie's new book, Black Pill, How I Witnessed the Darkest Corners of the Internet Come to Life, Poison Society, and Capture American Politics. You can follow Ellie on Twitter at
Elspeth Reeve.
Yeah, real name. Elspeth Reeve. Your Twitter handle threw me.
Just look, search ELLE Reeve. You'll find.
Yeah, you'll be fine. But it's ELSPETH Reeve. So, and that's double EVE. But do follow her work, and follow her work on CNN as well. We really appreciate Ellie taking the time and coming by and sharing some moments with us. Don't forget to do that thing you'd like that I love for you to do, that download thing. It's a great, it makes me feel all yummy inside. You know that. Share the podcast, share the download with your friends, get them connected to the Black Pill. And until next time, just go out and work on that tan like I do every week. I'm working on it and it's turning out pretty well. What do you think? It's good. It's good, you know. All right, folks, catch you next time.